up, everyone? I am your host, Jason Miles, and this is Revolution. And this is our episode with a young up-and-coming journalist from Canada named Owen Schock. I came across Owen's work about, I'd say, a little over a month ago. And he wrote an interesting piece on Canadian mining companies, and Burkina Faso. And after I read it, and it's not that long, it's about a 5 to 7 minute read, very informative. I sent it to the crew. The crew is pretty much the foreign policy crew. It's a daily conversation, as Cuba jokes, mostly memes. A lot of memes get shown, but obviously a lot of ideas get thrown around for who we think would be good for the show. We kind of ask collectively, and then it's always like, well, what's Jay say? Is it final word? Right. Does it fit? And after I read Owen's piece, I found a few more that he wrote, and he covers, I wouldn't say he covers Canadian imperialism. I think through the work that he's done, he sees it for what it is. And we wanted to do a show covering this, and at first I was going to be on this show. The break I took was kind of, I don't want to say an emergency, but it had to be taken. So sadly, after booking it and being the main point of contact for the guy, I wasn't on. But we figured, you know, Cuba's going to be there, Pascal's going to be there, it's all good. And I watched the show, actually, and I thought it was a great show. And Pascal wants to have Owen back to actually go more in depth on the IMF. He has some more writings on the IMF. So this was, I thought, a great show. Great bonus half discussion. These guys got even more in depth. If you want to hear that bonus half discussion, well, you got to become a patron. Patreon.com/Bitter Lake Presents. And if you listen to these conversations, you're like, I want to be a part of this conversation. I want to yell at Pascal and the guest, or I want to write in my disappointment about something someone said, or I want to be a part of this community too. The best way to do it, I would say, is YouTube. YouTube.com/ This is Revolution Podcast. Also, Twitch. We're very active with our Twitch chat as well. Wherever you're listening to this show, there are links in the description for all the social media: Facebook, Twitter, Twitch, Instagram. We try to upload all of the intro clips that you hear on Instagram. This one was I really enjoyed this one. Also, much like the previous one, there's some French in it. So it's better seen than heard. It ends with a clip of Thomas Sankara. The very vocal opponent of Western Empire in Burkina Faso. He knew, like Kwame Nkrumah, Walter Rodney, Hell, Fanon. I mean, the list goes on. But when we talk about Africa, we can't talk about Africa without talking about, as Walter Rodney says, how Europe underdeveloped Africa. The debt that these countries are put in. So this episode, you know, really goes in depth how a country like Canada, kind of quietly, owns 75% of the world's mining. And it's not just Africa. Canada has a very large hand in Latin America as well. The soft power, the soft empire. So again, youtube.com/thisisrevolutionpodcast every Tuesday and Thursday at 6 p.m. Pacific time. Saturday, the free show, the longer show, 9 a.m. Pacific time. And now we're doing shows on Wednesdays. Different shows every Wednesday. This Wednesday coming up, we'll be doing a special foreign policy show with Maria Repnikova, friend of show, original part of the foreign policy crew. Well, she's branching off. She's doing her own thing. On our channel, Wednesday night. I'm excited for it. Same bat time, 6 p.m. Pacific time. With that being said, when I hear this part of the trippy instrumental, I know I'm going to hear that, which is my cue. So please enjoy this episode. The last episode without me. Thank you guys, everyone, for listening. And I am out.
Good evening and welcome to This is Revolution. I am your acting host, Pascal Robert. Our normal host, Jason Miles, is still on vacation. This is his last day of vacation and he will be back with us for our Saturday free show. Today we have a fascinating subject we will be discussing, Canadian imperialism. And what does that mean about the image of Canada? We have a wonderful guest that will be discussing that with us. And we have one of our normal members of the foreign policy crew, a former consultant with the Department of Defense, Dr. PhD, the one, the only, Kuba Wierzynski, also known as Deep State Kuba. No soundboard.
Hello, everyone.
No soundboard, Kuba. Don't take it personally.
I don't. I had all of the people who normally applaud waterboarded, so it would be nice
there
if
you go. Came on. There you go. You, of course, would know such things because, you know, Deep State Kuba, obviously. But before we bring in our guest, our wonderful host and capitán, El Jefe, Jason Miles, produced a video for today's episode, and let us go to the intro video.
I'd like to begin by thanking our hosts, President Kuczynski and the people of Peru, for such a warm welcome. This summit was a chance for APEC members to tackle the challenges facing the global opportunity and to seize the global community and to seize the opportunities that lie ahead. A central theme of our discussions this weekend was the need to encourage freer trade in the Asia-Pacific region. We know that increased economic cooperation has the potential to expand new opportunities for business owners, help create well-paying middle-class jobs, and to increase prosperity.
Home to 75% of the world's mining companies, Canada is the imperial power that is seldom discussed. While the election of Justin Trudeau was thought to bring progressive change, it's been more of the same capital-driven, environmental and labor abuse under the charade of enlightened imagery. Is Canada benefiting from an incorrect assumption of progressivism? Or is Canada another usual suspect in the global game of empire and conquest? We'll ask these questions and more. This is Revolution.
Notre pays produit suffisamment de quoi nourrir. Nous pouvons dépasser même notre production, malheureusement. Par manque d'organisation, nous sommes encore obligés de tendre la main pour demander des aides alimentaires. Ces aides alimentaires qui nous bloquent, qui nous inspire, qui installe dans nos esprits cette habitude, ces réflexes de mendiant, d'assister.
Another wonderful and thought-provoking video from our man, El Jefe, El Comandante, Jason Miles. And we are going to introduce our guest, the great Owen Schalk, who is a writer from Winnipeg, Manitoba, in Canada. He grew up in the countryside, surrounded by rural emptiness, abandoned houses, and farm-loving German-Canadians who tried and failed to instill their love of farming in him. He found his artistic curiosity while reading the usual canon and found his voice while reading Pynchon, Delio, Bolaño, and other authors who write with a critical eye for dominant social and political doctrines. Owen's short stories have been distributed by a variety of print and online publishers, including the Paragon Press, the Anti-Langorius Project, and Whimperbang. Additionally, his academic work has been awarded with a number of scholarships and awards in Manitoba. Let us give a This Is a Revolution round of applause for Owen Schalk. Thank you.
Hello.
Owen, I appreciate you coming on. I have been, in preparation of this episode, reading your work published in the Canadian publication, Canada and Dimension, and your very, very, very eye-opening work on Canadian imperialism. What I would actually like you to do, for those who just watched the intro video, who saw one of my favorite African leaders and Pan-African revolutionary leaders, Thomas Sankara, may be asking themselves, what does Thomas Sankara have anything to do with Canada? Why would Jason and the guys at This Is Revolution be putting Thomas Sankara, former leader of Burkina Faso, in a film about Canadian imperialism. Well, for those who have not read the work of our wonderful guest, Owen Schalk, that answer is going to come about now. Owen, can you put Canadian imperialism, particularly of the mining form, in the context of why it's important in understanding the contemporary moment in Burkina Faso and Thomas Sankara?
Absolutely. So I think if we're trying to get an understanding of Canadian imperialism, what we have to understand first and foremost is how the Canadian ruling class views itself in relation to the world, and particularly in relation to the traditional colonial powers of Europe. So coming out of World War II, Lester B. Pearson, who was the Secretary of State for External Affairs and then the Prime Minister from 63 to 68, he was very clear in aligning Canada with Europe, with the colonial powers of Europe. And pursuant to that, he would diplomatically and economically defend the British Empire, the French Empire, and the Dutch Empire in their colonies of Indochina, of Indonesia, and Malay. And he would give diplomatic support to these groups, and he actually sent $60 million in military aid to the French in trying to squash the anti-colonial resistance movement in Indochina. And when I say he, I'm speaking by extension of about the Canadian government. And so that's how Canada has viewed itself historically, as basically another imperial power, but pursuing imperial ends by different means, because it has always lacked that sort of unilateral military power that the former colonial powers of Europe and now the United States have. So in a lot of cases, Canada will try to exert economic control over countries, particularly in the global south, through foreign aid. And what that often looks like on the ground is providing aid to mining companies through CETA, or the Canadian International Development Agency, which today is known as Global Affairs Canada. And this aid will come in the form of oftentimes just corporate welfare, just transferring millions of dollars to these companies. And oftentimes it will come in the form of prospecting, actually going around and finding the minerals which these companies then exploit. So, for example, I was just talking to Doug Miller of Amandla Radio in Montreal, and he spent a lot of time in Malawi. And he said that once, while he was leaving a flight from Malawi, he heard people talking about a group of Canadian advisors who had come to Malawi to rewrite the country's mining code in order to liberalize it. And this is often funded by Canadian aid agencies. This has happened in Colombia, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, I believe also in Ghana. And similar things have happened in Burkina Faso. So right now, the largest export of Burkina Faso is gold. It surpassed cotton in, I believe, 2009. And over half of the gold mines in Burkina Faso are owned by Canadian companies. And it's been that way for quite some time. Thomas Sankara, who you saw in the video in the beginning, actually nationalized Burkina Faso's mineral wealth after the revolution in 1983. But when he was killed by his former advisor, Blaise Compaoré, working with French regional actors like Félix Houphouët-Boigny in the Ivory Coast, it was privatized. And in the 1990s, the IMF and the World Bank encouraged the privatization of Africa's mineral wealth. And that's what happened in Burkina Faso. So the model of governance that Sankara promoted was completely destroyed, which is more to the pity because now Burkina Faso is one of the most impoverished countries in West Africa. And all of this wealth that could completely transform the society and that would have under a model of the type Sankara promoted is being basically vacuumed away by mostly Canadian companies.
Fascinating. One of the things that you do very, very eloquently in one of the pieces of yours that I read was discuss how Canadian mining interests weave so effectively in the projects of economic neoliberalization that were promoted in the global south, particularly in the area. I mean, this was promoted in the 50-year counter-revolution, which is a theme of our show profoundly, but particularly in the 90s and in the early aughts, even more extensively so. You even incredibly cite to the famous Larry Sumner's memo, in which Sumner's was caught out there. He has subsequently said that he was being sarcastic, where Sumner's in the Sumner's memo suggested that we dump all of the toxic waste we have in the developing world, in third world and poor developing countries, because basically they can suffer the economic losses and no one's going to miss it anyway. And he subsequently said that was a joke. Can you explain for our audience how Canadian mining interests were able to benefit from the move towards neoliberalization in the global South? And can you also expand on the extent and perhaps history of Canadian mining overall? But start with the project of neoliberalization in Canadian mining, if you will.
Totally. So I think if we're talking about this, we have to talk about aid as well, because Canadian foreign aid is basically how this global mining industry is promoted from Canada. So in around 1989, I believe, CETA got a new chairman, a guy by the name of, I think, Marcel Massé, and he basically converted Canadian aid into a neoliberal model. And he became interested in, and by extension, the Canadian government became interested in promoting neoliberalization across the global South to the benefit of Canadian companies. And to this end, he would put a lot of funds in the pockets of Canadian mining companies, because that was a very powerful, and still is a very powerful, industry based in Canada. And so one of the clearest examples of this, I think, comes in Colombia, actually, because in 1997, the Canadian International Development Agency gave, I believe, $11 million to Colombian lawyers who had represented multinational companies, including mining companies, I believe, and the Canadian Energy Research Institute, which is a Calgary-based think tank, which is very interested in promoting the interests of the extractive sectors in Canada. And this $11 million was used by these two groups to rewrite the Colombian Mining Code. And one of the things this did was lower the royalty rates that were due to the government by foreign companies from 10% to 0.4%. And it also included certain handouts to corporations, like if they had to cut down timber in order to then begin digging for a mine, they could export that timber tax-free for, I think, 30 days. So the neoliberalization of the global South, it was a project that was pushed by Canada through a lot of these agencies to the benefit of its own mining industry, which at this point was seeking markets elsewhere, because Canada, coming out of the 1970s, was absolutely incorporated into this neoliberal process. You have groups like the BCNI, the Business Council of, I forget the rest of the acronym, but it became the Business Council of Canada. And they were very interested in pushing free trade and neoliberalism at the governmental level. And eventually BCC got ins with the Mulroney government, and it basically merged with the government. So now neoliberalism is essentially what Canada exports everywhere it goes, often through these aid companies, to the benefit of Canada's mining sector.
If I could chime in for a second.
Cuba, go ahead. By the way, for those who do not know, Cuba is a Canadian national. So, you know, this is his homeland.
Yes. I was born in Poland, but I grew up in Canada. So I don't know if that makes me more or less Canadian. But I just want to put the Canadian neoliberal project within the larger context of the global neoliberal turn. And Canada has a long history of being an adjunct or a lieutenant to somebody else's imperial project. Canada was a dominion within the Commonwealth, the British Commonwealth, which enabled it to have preferential access to the resources and the markets within other British possessions. And after World War II, there was the decolonization period when it moved from being a junior partner of the UK to a junior partner of the United States within what ended up becoming the rules-based international order, mostly about economic liberalization and economic pressure on developing countries in the global south to provide preferential access and preferential treatment of foreign investors, especially Western interests. Different Western countries that were all generally partners in this process specialized in different sectors. The Canadians were involved in mining minerals. There were other countries that specialized in oil extraction, pharmaceuticals, you know, Nestle and processed foods, and has tried to, you know, and for a long time, Nestle was actually a Swiss company pushing for the neoliberalization of drinking water. And this is just to point out that this was a global process where the Canadian mining interest was a slice, but the pressure on the global south, because it was multilateral and it came from a number of Western governments, a number of advanced economies, was that much harder to resist.
Okay, thank you for that input as well, Kuba. Owen, do you want to follow through?
Totally. So bringing that into the present now, and specifically into West Africa, because that's the areas that I've focused on in a lot of my recent articles, this pressure, this same pressure that ended up overthrowing Sankara and bringing Burkina Faso into this state of constant underdevelopment, or rather continuing the process of underdevelopment that had also existed pre-Sankara, we see in Burkina Faso, as I said, 60% of gold mines owned by Canadian companies. In Mali right now, two of the largest gold mines, the Loulo-Gounkoto gold mine and the Fekola gold mine, I believe, are also owned 80% and 90% by Canadian companies. And just for perspective, Canada often talks about being a very generous power on the world stage, being a promoter of human rights, of peacekeeping, development, all that. But I did some research into the actual sum total of all Canadian aid development programs to Mali since 2000. And I believe the total of these programs, 21 years, is about $1.5 billion. In 2021, in one mine, the Fekola gold mine, the profit that was made from that mine was around $600 million, I believe, which went to B2 Gold, a Canadian company. So that really puts it into perspective that the cash flow through one of these companies, which is owned by a Canadian company, is equal to around a third, or I think actually closer to 40% of all of the money that goes back into Mali over 21 years, which really just emphasizes what Walter Rodney talked about, this process of underdevelopment really being linked to the expropriation of profit, which does not get back to the continent. And so Africa is left to languish in this constant state of underdevelopment while the exploiters continue to industrialize and profit.
Walter Rodney being the great Guyanese Pan-Africanist scholar and intellectual who wrote How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, who was also mysteriously assassinated or killed by political enemies, someone that we should actually do a show to discuss more often on This Is Revolution. One of the things that you did that I found very fascinating, and you touched on it in your last commentary just now, is that you talk about how this facade of Canada being a generous in terms of its foreign aid is really undermined by the fact that when you look at the profit ratio to the aid ratio, to how much money Canadian corporations make in these countries, like Burkina Faso, like in Mali, like in West Africa, the profit margin is incredible compared to the actual amount of aid that is given. Can you elaborate a bit more on that, if you don't mind?
Totally. So in the article that I did focusing on Burkina Faso, I point out that the value of Canadian corporate holdings in Burkina Faso, I think specifically in the mining industry, is about $3 billion. And I compared that with a number of studies on how much money it would actually cost to alleviate hunger, to actually eliminate hunger in all of Africa and then also in certain regions in Africa. And one of the studies said that in order to get Africa totally food self-sufficient, it would require around, I think, $5 billion, which is potentially an optimistic estimate, which is why I paired it with another one that said, in order to eliminate hunger, and it was 8 or 9 other countries, I forget which ones, but they were all on the African continent, it would require an investment of, I think, $1 to $2 billion more dollars a year for about 10 years. So what you see there is that all of the value of Canadian corporate holdings in Burkina Faso, which is one of the poorest countries in Africa, it has been made poor, I should say, by these imperial countries, is that money could easily go back into the African continent. And if we're going by the first estimate, it could become very close to ending hunger on the continent. If we're going by the other one, it could cover about 2 to 3 years of hunger elimination in those 10 or so countries. So the disparity is enormous that we see there. And if we're trying to see the reality of Canada on the global stage, we have to look at these numbers, because if we just take Canada's word for it, well, then Canada is doing the best that it can to help these countries. And well, there must be something wrong with these countries by logical deduction if they're simply unable to develop themselves with all this money that Canada is lavishing upon them. And that, I mean, that's just a racist assertion. And if we look at the actual numbers, we see that, no, these countries are being forcibly deprived. And if we're talking about West African countries, particularly Burkina Faso, it is Canada that is doing that depriving.
One thing that I would point out is that it's an issue of where the profits are going. If there were a reasonable royalty rate being paid to the government of Burkina Faso or the government of Mali, then there could be a sort of mutually beneficial relationship, because the infrastructure of Canadian mines, the technology and the know-how, that has a real value. The scandal and the exploitation is that the expatriation of the profits, right? That is not shared with the local country. And much of the pressure that Canada and other governments through this neoliberal turn that really begins in the 90s, and through the use of sovereign debt and IMF debt crises to force structural adjustment onto governments in the global south, has to do with creating the political conditions where foreign investors, Canadian mining companies among them, are exempt from regulations and have the opportunity to pull out the profits that they accrue from their local operations. And I think that one piece that we also need to look at is how Western powers and international corporations apply political influence to promote local elites that are willing to be complicit in rewriting legal regulations, rewriting mining codes, rewriting rules on the movement of investment funds and profits for the benefit of those companies. It's the comprador class that Pascal has referred to in the past, and that is the local face and a crucial element of the overall system of exploitation.
Yes, this is a concept that was very well elaborated by Kwame Nkrumah in his book on neocolonialism. Franz Fanon warned about the rise of this class. Amilcar Cabral's theory of class suicide was basically considered a solution for the development of this class. And all of these intellectuals basically warned about the fact of when colonial independence is won, that there will develop a black comprador elite or neo-colonial bourgeoisie, if you will, that will facilitate, under the guise of national liberation, if you will, the wealth extraction and oppression of these countries in the global South to the benefit largely of the same imperialists that have been grounding these countries to powder and dust for a century or more. And what has been the unfortunate reality is that all of those great radical revolutionary leaders and intellectuals were absolutely correct in that that is exactly what happened. And if you read the great work of Cedric Johnson, Revolutionaries to Race Leaders, which Jason and I have been discussing several times on this show, there's an amazing quote, I forgot the name, I don't have the book in front of me, by a gentleman who was a SNCC activist in that book. And that book is basically about the rise and development of the black political class out of the Black Power era. And one of the things that is the SNCC activist said is that it may take black folk in America having black political leaders govern over them to realize that race alone in of itself is not going to assure liberation from the oppressive system that folks find themselves in. And I'm paraphrasing, obviously. So Kuba is not incorrect in noting the...
not incorrect. I'll take that.
No, he's absolutely correct, quite frankly. And the nefarious, insidious, treacherous, and class collaborative role of the comprador bourgeoisie. In America, we call them the black political class as well. But at the same time, understanding that these people work in concert with imperial powers does not absolve the ultimate responsibility for this nefarious behavior from these imperial forces as well, who use these comprador, elite as, their bagman, pawns, puppet. And by the way, it's not only in Africa and the global African diaspora this exists. Our producer, Dean Bajlan, would acknowledge that this happens in the Middle East, in the Muslim world, in Asia, throughout the third world, developing world, and the global South. This phenomenon of a comprador bourgeoisie or neocolonial bourgeoisie is a toxic reality the post-colonial world has to deal with, and some have been more effective in dealing with than others. Let's go to Kuba. Kuba, you want to?
When I was looking into international political economy and comparative national development trajectories, it actually was easier to identify cases where you didn't get into this underdevelopment relationship with a local comprador class and liberalized trade relations with core economies. It was easier to find exceptions than it was to count all of the cases where that was the political economic reality and that held the country back. I mean, basically you have a few border sort of liminal countries around the EU, going from, Poland down to Turkey, and then the East Asian and Southeast Asian tiger economies. India and China are large enough to sort of have their own center of gravity. But apart from that, it's a depressing pattern. It's the same in Brazil and Burkina Faso. It's the same in Bangladesh and Cambodia. Sometimes the resource that's being extracted is human labor. Sometimes it's minerals, sometimes it's oil. But that relationship of a template for economic liberalization pushed by the international community, like they called it the Washington Consensus for a while, now it's the rules-based international order, with a local leadership that's compromised either through kleptocracy or through transnational class linkages, delivering, you know, like you said, being the bagmen, being the enforcers of that local legal order that allows for the exploitation and expropriation.
Well, cool. But to be fair and honest, let's not mitigate the fact that oftentimes when you have leaders of the that come out of the grassroots or the actual masses who are trying to buck the trend of being stepping fetches for fat,
they get shot.
They get assassinated. Yeah, nope. They get cooled. They get, you know, displaced. And let's also not forget that many of these comprador elites, particularly in Africa and in the West, from former British colonies, where do they go to school? They go to Sandhurst. And, you know, we all know, Cuba, if you want to put Sandhurst in context for our audience of what Sandhurst represents in terms of global management as a you know, military academy, it's basically where the third world British former colonial bosses go learn to be bad bagmen.
It's the school of the Americas, UK.
It's the school of the Americas, UK, if you will.
With polo.
But we are deviating from the conversation. Oh, and you, I'm glad you said you were doing research on this. Can you talk about Canadian imperialism, if you want to get into gold and otherwise, and Haiti, being a son of the Haitian Revolution that I am? I would love to hear you discuss that. If possible.
For sure. I would also just sort of add on to what you guys were talking about in terms of the comprador class and bring it back to Canada in that regard. What came to mind immediately was, again, Burkina Faso and Blaise Compaoré, who really served this one particular company extremely well. And that company was Semafo, which was a Montreal-based mining company, which got into so much heat, in fact, that it actually ended up getting in trouble, which is not common for Canadian mining companies. Usually they get away scot-free with stuff, but they were involved with strike breaking all over West Africa. They didn't pay almost any taxes. They were in very close with the Compaoré government. And eventually the heat got so much that they simply were amalgamated into another company, bought out by Endeavour Mining. And now they're just sort of off the scene. And then another one that came to mind is Kyrgyzstan, where you have the Kumtor gold mine, which is owned by a Canadian company named Centerra. And you actually have a situation now where this comprador class is sort of changing. And there's now a president in power named Sadir Japarov, who is trying to reclaim the mine. And there is this ongoing, really vicious legal battle going on between Japarov and Centerra. And Japarov has his own motives. He's sort of a nationalist conservative who wants to reclaim the mine on nationalist grounds. Some people think it's a very cynical attempt to get sort of popularity from his voting base, but it's still extremely interesting in Kyrgyzstan, where you have sort of the collapse of this traditional comprador class and a really savage legal battle currently going on that I would encourage everyone to follow. But now, just to jump over to Haiti really quick, Canada's role in Haiti has been really atrocious over the past few decades. For example, with Jean-Bertrand Aristide, when he comes to power and he comes to power the second time, and he starts to reclaim some of his more radical language from his first presidency, calling on France to repay the 1825 indemnity that was levied against Haiti, where France forced the Haitians to repay, I believe, $21 billion in properties that were lost.
In modern amounts, mm-hmm. That's correct.
In properties that were lost during the revolution, including human beings. And scholars identify that moment as sort of the moment when Haiti began to slip into underdevelopment and this cycle of poverty that we see today.
I mean, there was also the fact that the United States was unwilling to trade and did not see Haiti as an acceptable economic partner either.
Of course, yeah.
I'm not trying to mitigate the like really odious nature of the French indemnity and the damage that it did, but Haiti's position on independence was extraordinarily precarious, and the international environment was extraordinarily hostile, largely because you had armed imperial powers that would have taken any pretext to undo the revolution.
Of course, yeah, that's important to add too, is the sort of bring, you can't excuse the other imperial powers just because France's role was so particularly awful.
And I think that the rather than like talking about Canadian imperialism, this is more like the Canadian branch of a global capitalist imperialism. The fact that there is this collusion between major economies, you know, the EU, the United States, even advanced Asian economies through vehicles like the TPP, attempt to impose a system of rules that's advantageous to them with, you know, dividing up the spoils internally between them. But the Canada by itself, if it had to rely on its own hard power and its own economic clout, wouldn't be able to get such a uniformly advantageous environment for its international mining companies. But because it's all packaged together, and things, international financing through the IMF is contingent on accepting these rules, currency, access to international currency, likewise, access to Western markets for your exports, all of this is dependent on accepting these rules that allow for countries to be strip mined, with all the profits being repatriated, and not often, not even to Canada, not even to the source of the.
Hey, listen, Cooper, we're not trying to give these maple syrup eating Canucks a pass so quick, all right, buddy?
No, it's fine. Like, I'm just saying, it's an entire system, right? And the money ends up in offshore tax shelters as well. There's part of this which is maddening, that for all the dirty work that's being done on behalf of these mining companies, the mining companies themselves aren't great citizens of the metropole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what you were talking about there with Canada as a branch of a larger project, going back to the specifics of this Aristide presidency in the early 2000s, we definitely see that, because you see this sort of coalition forming with the intention of ousting Aristide. And the three major players in that are France, the United States, and Canada.
There was a meeting that was actually held, I believe, in Ottawa. What is the name of the meeting and what's the actual date? There was a meeting at a specific date where it was decided that, you know, Haitian sovereignty, flush that down the toilet. This guy's not working up for us in the way we want. He's got to go.
Yeah, that was at Meech Lake in Ontario. And it was, I forget the exact date. I believe it was in 2004 sometime, but they basically decided that by the end of the year, Aristide had to go, and they had to remove him before the next scheduled elections. And that's what ended up happening. I mean, you see these paramilitaries coming over from the Dominican Republic, causing a lot of chaos in the country, which is then sort of used as an excuse by these countries to apply more diplomatic pressure onto Aristide. And eventually it just gets so bad that he is, in his words, kidnapped by the military. He is flown out of the country on an American plane and deposited in the Central African Republic, and whose country's military ended up securing the airport for him to leave. It was the Canadian military.
It's lovely, lovely. That's absolutely correct. That's true. That's, well, I mean, listen, our goal here, listen, we are in the United States, what some people here would call the imperial core. So obviously us trying to make it seem like Canada is the, you know, the biggest, baddest, you know, offender on the block of, in terms of global imperialism, would be problematic. But the argument we're making is that Canada, excuse me, is one of the usual suspects.
Absolutely.
In this overall project. So the question I want to ask Owen, and maybe both of you can answer this, is that How does Canada, how is Canada allowed to maintain this facade, this illusion, this patina of woke liberal progressivism? We're in touch with our native, with our indigenous peoples, and you know, in the like, you know, we love everybody, and we're all so kind and well mannered. Like, how? And I'm not going to lie, right? I mean, I have family, as you probably both probably know. There's a relatively large population of Haitians that live in Canada, particularly in Quebec and Montreal. I have a significant amount of family that lives in Canada, and coming out of the United States being its rather tortured racial history in my personal life, Canada used to seem like, oh, this wonderful kind of just like, you know, progressive, you know, racist-free Shangri-La when I was a kid going up there to visit in the summertime. And I will, even in my time as a writing as an anti-imperialist, I was sadly snookered into a kind of looking at Canadians in Canada as this kind of like progressive alternative to, you know, the hardcore racial reality of the United States. And it was through, you know, the investigation and doing further reading and being exposed to some of my comrades who were like, no, man, no, don't sing the praises of these Canucks, brother, at all. There's a lot of dirt under their fingernails. So to Owen, and Cooper, you can jump in too, is that what is the mechanism that allows Canada to really create this charade of facade?
For sure. So I think if we're talking about this sort of woke branding of Canada, we have to separate Justin Trudeau's specific brand from that. And we have to go back a lot further in history to the post-war era and this idea of liberal internationalism or Pearsonian internationalism, named after the former Secretary of State for External Affairs and Prime Minister Lester B. Pearson, who is more than any other figure in Canadian history sort of deified in the Canadian political imagination as the figure that Canadians should aspire to be like. And this idea of Pearsonian internationalism is dependent upon a belief that Canada acts in a benign or benevolent way on the global stage through multilateral institutions such as the UN in order to achieve basically outcomes that are good for all the parties involved. And one of the biggest myths, or rather one of the biggest constituent factors of this process of myth-making is the Suez Crisis, which Lester B. Pearson is involved in arbitrating, and then later the Congo Crisis, which sort of has this very problematic idea around it, that Canada was a neutral party, when if you in fact look into that, you see that the Canadian peacekeepers were actually extremely anti-Lumumba, and it was actually a Canadian peacekeeper who tipped off Mobutu of Lumumba's location, which led to him being murdered. So this idea of Canada as a progressive place, it comes out of this history, this myth-making, this idea of Canada as a liberal internationalist state. And if you really look into it, there's no basis for it, except that Canada often puts economic and trade interests over security and military interests, in the sense that it does not militarily intervene in countries in the way that the United States does, but rather it works behind the scenes, and this allows a veneer of neutrality to emerge, when in fact it's simply this lack of overt hard power, I think, that contributes to this false veneer of Canadian progressivism.
I think that one important distinction to be made is between, like, when we talk about the brand of Canada, the image that people have of Canada as a progressive place or as a benign international actor, there's the domestic arrangements within Canadian society, there's its behavior internationally. Even within the behavior internationally, there's different strains in it. For instance, Canada has a relatively good relationship with Cuba, compared to especially the United States. Fidel Castro, I believe, was one of the pallbearers at Trudeau's father's funeral. So for what that's worth, it does indicate some cooperation between the two countries. But I think that when it comes to natural resource extraction, you have very rapacious mining interests that are very closely connected to elements of the Canadian elite that are that constitute part of the Canadian elite, and that have essentially captured many of the foreign policy mechanisms of the country. Most Canadians, like most Americans, don't care about politics that much, and don't care about their history that much, so are unaware of this. And the benchmarking to the United States on things like race relations, multiculturalism, and other social issues also creates a sense of complacency, because as long as you're, you know, you don't have to outrun the line, you just have to be faster than the other guy. That helps Canada look good. So it's a matter of branding to a large extent. The fact that you can free ride on an international imperial system that other people enforce with hard power. And the fact that on a domestic level, Canadian society isn't bad. You know, I think that you admitted to feeling a certain warmth, like about Canada as a place. It's easier to live than in the U.S. And that, as an immigrant, it was much more welcoming for me and my family, coming from Poland, than the United States was when I tried to pursue a career in Washington. So there's the reality of the domestic society that's counterposed to what it's doing internationally. But in the chat, somebody described it that Canada runs with the gang. And when it comes to the international order of capitalism, I think that that's a great way of putting it.
We're going to move on to some of our super chats here. What is the legacy of Pierre Trudeau? He came to power before the counter-revolution. I believe he's referring to our 50-year counter-revolution, and left office in the mid-80s. Neoliberal or no? Owen, you want to take that?
Yeah, I could talk for a bit about it, and then I'll pass it to Kuba, because what I know primarily is foreign policy. That's where I focus a lot of my time and energy. So if we're talking about Trudeau as a figure of the Canadian foreign policy, when we see what he was pursuing, what he said he was pursuing, was sort of a middle way, or a third way is what he called it. Sort of not an American capitalist foreign policy, not a Soviet communist foreign policy, but something different. And in that context, he was very keen about letting everybody know that Canada had cordial relations with Cuba. And he would go on like very visible trips there. All of the papers would cover it. It would be a huge thing. And he would use it then as a tool of domestic foreign policy to say, look, I'm not just a tool of the Americans, because that, as Jean Chrétien said at one point, you know, the electorate loves when I go with the Americans. But in terms of it, was he a figure who sort of continued seamlessly the move toward neoliberalism? I'll have to pass that to Kuba, I think.
I think that when you look at the big elements of the neoliberal turn, the privatization of crown corporations, corporate deregulation, that largely happened after Trudeau. Mulroney was the primary mover, and he's the one who signed the Canada-US free trade agreement, which enshrined those neoliberal policies not only in national law, where it could easily be reversed, but as an international treaty, where the mechanisms to reverse those rules involved international tribunals, compensation, lengthy consultation periods. And that it was explicitly designed to lock in the neoliberalism that Reagan, Mulroney had both pursued as part of their domestic policy. Trudeau, he gets credit from me for at least domestically imposing price controls and limiting the the freedom of Alberta oil companies, the which was it was designed as a consumer consumer protection measure rather than a environmental policy, but the we've seen that without limitations, the Canadian oil and gas sector balloons into as serious a threat environmentally and economically as the mining sector. Right now in British, my home province of British Columbia has basically a neo-colonial pipeline project being driven through it against the will of many Indigenous groups, as well as the provincial government, the democratically elected, constitutionally established and defined provincial government in Victoria. Joe Horgan does not want the Trans Mountain pipeline to go through. They're pushing it through anyway, because Ottawa and the oil interests in Alberta are aligned on it. I think Trudeau the father gets, I have a bit of a soft spot for him, but Justin Trudeau lost me with the pipelines. That is, that's bringing in some of the worst aspects of Canadian foreign economic behavior right here, taking them home to the Western provinces.
Let's take this super chat. Can you speak on the current composition and state of the Canadian left? What are their priorities? Thank you, LME, LME.
Well, so if you're a person on the left in Canada and you have an investment in electoral politics, I think basically your only practical option would be voting NDP, which is the traditionally a social democratic option. In my opinion, it's a very flawed party in a lot of ways, but if you are of the mind that getting a few good and necessary reforms through is enough, like something, you know, like some kind of environmental protections, a wealth tax, student debt relief, then NDP would be the way to go. You could also vote for the Communist Party of Canada because we do have that. But I would say their chances of winning really anywhere are pretty slim. So I would say Communist Party would be your Canadian lefty idealist option, but NDP would be your more pragmatic option, I suppose.
So is there a major activist core? Do they have a quote-unquote Corbyn Sanders phenomenon at all in Canada?
That's the NDP.
Mm-hmm. At this point, I don't know if they create the same sort of energy among the electorate that a Sanders or a Corbyn did. Jagmeet Singh is... He's doing okay, but I don't really see him creating this moment around himself that Sanders or Corbyn were able to do. Maybe Kuba, you disagree. I don't know.
Well, I think that the risk is overstating what Sanders and Corbyn were able to do because they both lost, right? Ultimately, those were flashes that didn't actually managed to change the center. And the rules around Canadian electoral politics, namely the first past the post single member district system, heavily disadvantages the NDP. Their support is spread out, so they often fail to convert votes to seats. But their existence, I think, as a separate party, rather than what you have in the United States or the UK, where you have Labor or the Democrats with a left wing and neoliberal wing, I think it helps keep pressure on the Liberal Party to prevent a wholesale capitulation to the hegemonic Western neoliberalism. But in Canada, a lot of the activist energy also blends in with identity groups. So First Nations, there's a great deal of energy on securing their ancestral rights and forcing the government to live up to its obligations to Indigenous Canadian groups. You also have other visible minority groups that have an activist core. And sometimes these compete with the economic message of the NDP. Often they work hand in hand to amplify each other's message.
Well, we're coming down to the last 2 minutes. Owen, hopefully we can see you in our after hours Patreon only section. Can we get at least a half hour, maybe more out of you? Are you down to come on?
Sure. I'll do 20 minutes, 30 minutes for sure.
Okay. We'll send you a link. We'll see you there. Kubo, you'll be joining us in the Patreon only section as well.
Try to stop me.
All right. Wonderful. Well, I'm glad that we were able to have this conversation about Canada and discuss some of its imperialist adventures in the world, particularly in the global south.
Oh, I want to talk about Chrystia Freeland in the patron section.
We can talk about that. Like and subscribe. Also, check out our link for merchandise. Check out the merch. We've got some funky, fresh merch. Also, come into the Discord. Leave some comments. We'll be popping in here and there. By the way, you can give super chats during the patrons only section. Don't forget, Saturday, all man 50 grand. Jason Miles will be coming back as the host, and I will be taking up my normal role as the co-host. I hope that in Jason's absence, I have been able to keep the high standards that we try to maintain here at This Is Revolution in the eyes of our fans, our super chat, and our chat participants, as well as our audience. And I did not disappoint any of you all. But my partner in this endeavor, Jason Miles, will be back on Saturday, where we'll be talking about post-Marxism, post-leftism. And we'll also have the one and only Greg Tate talking about Black popular culture and the Black American culture at the same time. So coming down to the end of our show, we look forward to seeing you all on Saturday. It's going to be a pretty live show. Thank you for supporting This Is Revolution podcast. Become a patron if you have not. And on that note, we are out.